Another one of the things I have written down on my index card of five things not to do is actually something I haven't been doing, and that's bother students at least once every 5 minutes. And it occurs to me, I just started the sentence with "and," which is another thing on that list. Anybody read the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin? Remember when he's talking about how to improve yourself, how to give yourself characteristics that would build you as a person? He said you should write down the characteristics you want on a piece of paper, and you should have a little grid, 5 by whatever or 7 by whatever grid. And then you should pick one of these characteristics per week and keep account of the number of times you do that characteristic. And the idea being that as you increase the number of times you do it per day, you'll just do it automatically. And then in the next week, you go down to the next characteristic. As I've been running through the audio for this class and sanitizing it, I've been doing sort of the reverse of that. I've been noticing all the times that I don't do things, like I do start sentences with "and" as opposed to not starting them with "and." I've come to the conclusion that I'm never going to be Ben Franklin. And now I forgot what I was talking about. Oh, yes, bother students every 5 minutes. When I was walking here today, among the many good ideas I had when I was walking here, is that I thought of a new way to bother students. So I'll start off today. My suspicion is that, let me not poison how I anticipate it will go. But normally I start off with a review of what we talked about last time, and as you remember, one of my problems is it takes me 45 minutes to get through the review. This time I'm going to turn it over to the students. What did we talk about on Thursday? Sorry?
Tuesday.
Oh, that's right. I wasn't here on Thursday. That's why we have the quiz. Sorry. Yes, on Tuesday. A week. A whole week I'm making you remember. No, it's terrible. Okay, anything in particular?
And as far as what has access to what members of the pathogens.
Oh, you know, I could turn this also, see, always thinking, whether it's good or not is another question. I could also turn this into attendance.
I guess I'll just go with packages.
Let's go back. Yeah, it was last week. Let's go back to scope. What did we learn about scope? This actually, it is kind of unfair because I'm sort of expecting you to go chronologically through the way that we went through it. But I mean, you have your notes, so you have somebody's notes. Well, you're next, so don't let it wander away too far.
So is that with packages?
Yeah, that's
these are the prevalent of
negative. Yeah, right. Scope, what's scope?
Scope is just like what has access to what it just calls namespace.
Okay. And so of the what kinds of scope did we introduce on Tuesday, a week ago?
Package scope.
Okay.
Object scope, assuming we did. As far as the variables within.
Right, classes. Right.
And we talked about how to differentiate between conflicting names. You gave the entire class back.
We'll leave that to somebody else. Well, there was one other scope that we talked about. There was package scope, class scope, and method scope. And what were, no, I'm sorry. Yeah, that was, those were the scopes. And we haven't gotten as far as the other question yet, so I will leave it at that.
Should I keep talking about scope?
No, I'll go on to the next thing we talked about.
I know we talked about with scope how
off of scope.
Off scope, so that's packages.
That leaves that takes us to packages.
Yeah. Packages are a name group of class files, and a package is a reference to the directories that all the files are held in? Is that
Well, tell us a little bit more. It could be. Depends on how you how you work it. Like anything else, depends on how you work it.
And to use something within that package, you have to state what package it's in, and then the name of the method or the class or the object.
Okay, so that's where you are heading from, heading towards.
And then per file, you can only have one public class.
Why is that?
Because the name of the source file has to be the same name as the public class.
Okay.
Otherwise,
but does that mean that I can't have more than one class in a file, in a source file?
No, you can have as many as you want, just one public.
Okay.
There could be multiple public inside of a single package.
You know, it suddenly occurs to me that doesn't make any sense. If you have a file, a source file, that contains a bunch of classes, when you compile that file, the classes get broken down into separate class files, and you use the name of the class for the name of the file.
Yeah.
So I have a public file, sorry, I have a public class, that gets put into a class file with the name of the class. Who cares what the name of the source file is? Clearly, the compiler needs to know the source file, but why? Why does the actually, it's not the compiler. JVM, when you run a program, you have to put the, I don't see when that's the case. Well, anyway, when you run the JVM, you have to specify the name of the package, at least, that contains main, because you're going to run main. Well, you actually don't have to run main. You can run whatever you want, but boy, I don't see why that's the case now. Does anybody know? Does everybody understand what I'm talking about? Apparently, you have to name the source file. You have to give the source file the same name as the public class. But why? Because the compiler would turn all those source classes into class files. Each one has their own name. Now, of course, if you have two classes in a file, they have to have different names. That makes sense, although actually in some languages you're allowed to accrete. I believe Python is one of them. You can accrete methods to a class just by reopening the class scope, in a sense, and sticking more. I think TCL's like that too, but TCL's weird. So not the case in Java. But that's just because you can't have two things with the same name. Or I suppose you could, because you would just overwrite one class file with the other class file. But now it's not clear to me why I need to have the name of the source file be the same as the public class. That doesn't make any sense. I
thought that had something to do with the fact that, you can have public methods in a private class.
Yes, yes. And that's another thing I was trying to figure out. Why? How does that make sense? Yeah. I was actually doing that last night. I was going around to my various little places on the internet that I use for Java Wisdom, and I wasn't actually, that's a tough question to Google for, first of all. It's got all these terms that are sufficiently generic that you just get everything. But I wasn't able to answer that question either, whether it made sense. My intuition is to say, that doesn't make sense, but I've been burned so many times with C++ and saying that, and then finding out that, in fact, it does make sense. To like private constructors. The first time I saw a private constructor, like, what the? Why would anybody want a private constructor? And it turns out it actually does make sense. So I am hesitant to say that, this particular construct is completely useless and no one would ever want to do it. But let's go back to the original problem. So the problem is, why do I need to have the name of the source file be the same as the name of the public class? Why is that necessary? And of course, it's necessary because the compiler was saying, the name of the source file isn't the same as the public class. So what? Who cares? But anyway, I interrupted you.
Then we talked about
So we're I'm sorry, where did you take us up to? You took us up to the name of the, you were talking about the names.
Yeah, the public class.
Okay. Yeah. See, I have to remember how much we have so that I can leave some stuff to talk about next.
It leads us to, I believe, class paths.
Okay.
Yeah. Which are basically a listing of package charges where programs are compiled and
all right.
Your files.
Okay.
You would compile your file in, say, a parent directory that contains the package directories, and you would have to specify the paths to these classes in these package directories in order for the compiler to find it.
Okay. Also the JVM.
Yes. I think there's a note in the book that says that it doesn't check to see if the directories really exist. Or something like that. I vaguely remember something about it, that you have to be careful that these files really exist over time, that they exist.
Right, we talked about that too. Perhaps. That's one of the ones that will kill you. I mean, if you get that wrong, because I told you how I get that wrong. You write a package and then you refactor the package.
Yeah,
but if you don't refactor the package declarations in the class, in the source file, then you run into this problem. So it's actually something that could very well occur.
Yeah. The thing I remember about ClassPass is that it starts in the current directory and goes down. So if you have something in a directory that's to the left or right on the same tree.
I guess I'm not understanding what that.
Your class path, if we go to Java compiler, it'll actually start in your current directory and look basically straight down.
Tell me what start in your current directory means.
The Java compiler, where it's looking for the .java files.
Oh, the source files? You can actually play the game with the source files too. We haven't talked about that, and I'm not going to, because it's not, unless you're writing very large, or not even very large, but unless you're writing large systems with lots of source files and you're doing multiple versions for various reasons, it's not that hard. It's just not something we need to worry about. So we can skip the source file. But you're right, you can't do that.
Class file in, say, directory A, like, let's say you had a structure where it was directory A, directory B, directory C.
Right.
If you had a dot class file here and here, and you were trying to use both of them in the same file, you had to start your class path with that.
That's right, that's right. The idea was you wanted to be in the closest ancestor to all your class, well, that's kind of dangerous to say, too. What I was going to say is you want to be in the closest ancestor to all your class, your package directories. But that's actually kind of dangerous because you still need to get from that ancestor down to, you still need to get from the ancestor down to the actual package directories, which suggests that the contents of your class path should be full directories as opposed to relative directories. Which actually I don't think is something I mentioned. I might want to put that in there. I don't think Horstman says that either. He might. But implicitly, by the examples he gives, they're all full paths. All right. Take us home.
Is that where you finished?
No, there's actually a few more things to talk about. I think, anyway. I could be wrong. Did we finish there or not?
I have a little bit more.
Okay. Nice try. And then you said, see you next week.
I'm not lying.
Actually, this is also kind of important. The last thing that we left there for, that we talked about on last Tuesday. Yeah, we talked about that. Tell us a little bit about that. Why do we have that? What's that there for?
Class path
wise. Oh, we can all read it. We'd like your interpretation of it.
I don't really remember.
All right, then what did we talk about after the class path environment variable? The interesting thing about the class path environment variable is that Horstman says, well, you know, don't use it because people screw it up, which I didn't think was a particularly useful criticism for environment using environment variables. There are some arguments that you can give, but the principal reason that you probably shouldn't use it is because if you actually look at a lot of the things that you run, for example, anybody who runs Dr. Java, the actual bin Dr. Java is a script. And it contains within it the Java execution. And there you can see it has a huge list of, has a huge class path list. And that's the problem, is that when you use the class path argument on the command line, you have to specify these very large lists. And again, they should be absolute paths. Although I suppose you could use relative paths. That's kind of dangerous. Because in that case, then it would depend on where you start, unless you're careful in writing your scripts. But then that's the same argument that Horstman uses for not using the environment variable. So you have a problem. You know, if you don't know what you're doing, you're going to get screwed no matter what. That was my argument against Horstman's claim, my argument against Horstman's argument for class path environment variables. But there are arguments in both directions. You should become familiar with both to the extent that you can use both. And if you have a preference one over the other, that's good, but you should understand what the properties are, because when you actually have to set up a Java program or system, you need to make the right decision, and that will be based a lot on the environment that you are working in and what you're trying to do. But you should think of using both of those and not just saying, well, I'm always going to use class path on the command line versus the environment variables. Of course, the nice thing about using the environment variables is that it's easier to change. I can, as Joe Random User, can sit there and change the class path environment variable to get a particular library I want to include or whatever. On the other hand, if you put everything in the script using the command line option, I can't change that. I can make a copy of it and change it, but that's a pain. Anything else? There's one other thing, I think. Yes, one other thing.
Did we get some method scope?
No, that's what we'll start talking about. But what was the thing we had talked about before method scope? Right, that's what we just, and there was something after that, I believe. Pardon me. Oh, yeah, we talked about two things. No. We talked about multiple packages. We talked about having multiple package directories, which then get combined together using a class path search mechanism. So you have one big package. That was... That's this.
I don't have better notes.
Ah, well, I'll take better notes.
Got pretty these from the...
There's your problem. This actually turns out to be a very useful technique because, like I said, it allows you to interpose code before the code that you would normally run through the regular class path search mechanism. There's a footnote here someplace on the notes that describes a particular instance where that's useful. If you're running unit tests using, for example, JUnit, one of the things you have to do is you have to write a bunch of test classes that then test the classes that are in your particular package. You can do that one of two ways. You can put the test classes in the same directory as the testing or to be tested classes. The problem there is that gives you a whole mess of classes in here that you don't really need, right? Because the testing classes are for you as the developer. When you release this to your users, you don't really want to put the testing classes in there because they are irrelevant to what the users want. They just want to have the class files from the system they're running. But if you put them all in one directory, then you have to be careful to clean them up and so forth and so on. An alternative mechanism is to have a separate package directory which contains only the testing classes. And then rely on the fact that the search through the class path list will go here first, assuming if you list the testing first, followed by this. That way, that has the effect of, in a sense, combining these two into one. So now what you have effectively is the testing and the testing, the testing classes and the to-be tested classes are in the same package, even though they are in separate directories. And that's a really nice way to arrange things, because then, because of course, not only do you have your source files, but you also have the, sorry, not only do you have the class files, but you have the source files from which you generated those. And you have even more files in your directory, which you probably don't want to clutter up for the release version of your software. So that's a good example of where you would use the fact that you can have multiple package directories with the same name and have those be effectively unioned together using the class path search.
Quick question.
Yes?
In the book, it describes a way of unit testing for testing each class, where you can have each class have that's in its own file, each one having its own name group.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
So you're suggesting not to do that, because in that sense, I guess what you can do is you have a, I'm equating it to C, C++ programming, where you have a main.c file that goes out and touch, and you have a whole bunch of other header files, other files that you end up compiling together. So you end up having the main Java file with all these other smaller Java files that include all the classes. And each of those Java files has its own main. I want to call it a function, but I know that's not the right. The main
it's a method.
Class method.
Right.
And then you can, when you compile this, you can either run the main, the top level Java program.
Right. Right.
Or you can run each individual.
Yes, that's right. That's right. That's what he's talking about. Is that in chapter 4?
Yes.
Is it? I don't remember that. Okay.
I think it's right before.
Let's talk about that a little bit. Although actually we probably should get going. But that's an interesting point, so let's talk about it. And we'll take an example ripped from real life. I'm writing a cribbage program, except I'm doing it in Smalltalk, so it's not quite the same thing. But in my cribbage program, I have things like hand. I have classes like hand. What else do I have? Card, game, the actual cribbage game. Now, if we were doing this in Smalltalk, each one of these would be a class. So I'd have I'd have class hand, class card, class game. What Patricia is mentioning is that what Horstman says, I can have class main here. Sorry, class hand. And I want to write a bunch of unit tests for this. I actually use S unit to do this. So I do have a bunch of unit tests, but they're in a separate class, which is what JUnit does too. If I wanted to test hand, I could also write, I forget actually, because I just upgraded to JUnit 4. So I'm not quite sure what you're supposed to do, but you do something like this, class. And there's some annotations up here. I forget what they are. I need to write, in addition to hand, I'd also need to write class test hand. And then in here, so for example, what does hand have? Hand has things like, anybody know how to play cribbage? You can do things like, there's a method called pair points, which returns the number of points you get for having pairs in your hand. I'd need to write a test for that. So I would have something like test pair points, and then there's pairs, there's runs, there's flushes, there's the right jack, there are 15. So there's all these different ways that I can accumulate points, and for each one of those, and this is a public method, for each one of those I'd have to write a test pair of points. And you would do things like give it a hand that has no points with respect to pairs and see that it returns zero. Then it should you have one pair and it should give you 2 points and so forth and so on. Now the question is, what packages do these things go? Actually, let me not do that. Let me go back to Patricia's point. That's one way to do it. The other way to do it is what Horstman says, which is to do this. We could do this, but let's be a little bit more informal. And Horstman's argument is that this is an informal technique for writing tests. So in a more disciplined environment, it would probably not be acceptable. But for a homework environment, for example, it would be perfectly okay. You write a main, our beloved main, as part of the hand class. And then in here, in the body of the main, you would write your tests. So I would write tests for pair points, I would write tests for flush points, and so forth and so on. Now if I want to, when I do my JUnit tests, I have to run specific tests. I have to run a specific command to do the tests. And so I need another jar file that I call and execute, and I have to get the command line arguments right, which I always forget to do. Here, the only thing you need to do is just compile the thing, compile the source file as you normally would. Now if I want to test hand, the only thing I have to do is call Java, assuming I get the class path right, hand.main. And that will automatically run the main, which would then run the tests. In the case of card, I would do the same thing. I'd have class card, and then that would have a bunch of, for example, it would have a query function called suit, which would return the card suit. It would have a query function called rank, which would be return the card rank. And then I'd have a main here. And in here, I would put tests of the rank and the suit, and there are a few other ones, like there's an ordering between cards, among cards. The point here is that essentially each class would have its own main, and when you run the main from the class, it would essentially run the tests. And that's actually a nice way to go. It's, like I said, it's pretty lightweight, it's pretty quick. It actually gets you around a lot of the problems that you would run into if you more formally test your code using a more formal mechanism. On the other hand, I would argue that that is a bad thing to avoid those, because if you have problems writing formal tests, and we're getting off the subject here, this is moving us towards software engineering. If you have problems writing tests for your class, that indicates that your class design perhaps is not quite as good as it should be. On the other hand, if you do this, you don't have those problems. Part of the problems you have is that because the JUnit tests are outside the class, you can't get inside the class and test things like private, which we haven't talked about. We'll talk about that today. But from your C++ experience, you should understand what that means. On the other hand, if you find that you need to test private things in a class, that suggests that your class design isn't good, or at least the class interface design is not good, in the sense that there are things that you would prefer to have available to you that aren't. And in order to get access to them, you have to subvert what you've set up. So that I personally like to see a little bit of difficulty in getting things set up correctly, because if you encounter that difficulty, or possible difficulty, because if you encounter that difficulty, then that suggests you're doing something wrong. On the other hand, this will just work. You can just do it, not have any problems. So this sort of removes a test of goodness of your code. On the other hand, maybe you're okay with that. Certainly if you're doing quick and dirty things. Of course, if you're doing quick and dirty things, you're probably not going to write tests anyway. Did I answer your question, or did you have a question?
Yeah.
Okay. One thing you have to be careful of is this of course, differs from C++ in the sense that you can't compile this and get an executable program, right, in C++, because you'd have main being multiply defined. That's the only problem there. Okay. You know, the problem with that is, of course, now I'm going to have to go through and cut out each one of those names as opposed to just cutting out a big block like I do when I normally take attendance. Oh, well. That's life. Today we start, this week we start Chapter 3, which is a chapter on basics. I mentioned last week that one of the things I'm going to do is drag forward our discussion that we started last week on classes and scopes and interfaces. No, actually, we haven't talked about interfaces yet. Classes and scopes into this week, because a lot of the things that you're reading for Chapter 3 this week should be very familiar to you. And I think that by stealing time to cover the important things that we're going to discuss today, we're not going to lose that much. We talked earlier about the different kinds of scopes that are available, and package scope and class scope. What I'd like to do now is talk a little bit about method scope. Not too much, because there's not much surprising about method scope, particularly with respect to your C++ knowledge. Method scope is independent of class scope. So in other words, you can assign two different access keywords to the class and the methods within the class. So you can have a public class and private methods, Or, as we were talking about earlier, you can have a public method and a private class, trying to figure out how that makes sense. By default, as with everything else, methods have package scope, which means that anything within the same package can access that method. Anything outside the package does not have the ability to access that method, which is what this says. Methods with public scope can be accessed from any class in any package, again, similar to public classes. Again, this is independent. Well, what's the catch-22 here? Why am I saying that this is such a big problem? Why? What's the difficulty with having, for example, a method with public scope in a class with package scope? Is that some sort of, I'm treating that as some sort of conceptual oddity, trying to understand why anybody would want to have such a thing. Is it? Or does it just make perfect sense? By perfect sense, I mean, is it consistent? Right.
So why would you want to put a public method in there?
Why not? What's the conceptual difficulty or consistent? Why is that inconsistent in some sense? Why does that cause trouble?
Because if somebody calls it and it screws things up, you don't know who called it, really. It could have been called from anywhere in that method.
No, back up. Try again. One other thing I have written down on my card is repeat the things that the students say, which you'll notice I just didn't do. I'll have to do that too. Let me tell you, Ben Franklin is a really tough person to emulate.
Let's say that you have a method in there that sets a variable.
No. You're going off in the wrong direction. You don't want to be, what we're talking about is access permissions, essentially. And my question is, what's the conceptual difficulty with having a public access method, not to be confused with a public access channel, public access method in a package access class? Why is that in some sense contradictory?
Somehow the subset has more, or people are given more privileges to a subset of a set that is given less access to it.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. But I don't think anybody else is. Why don't you try and clean that up a little bit?
Because you define the entire class as having less access to, or just package access, and yet you're giving a method in it, something that's considered part of it, more access.
Exactly. By declaring the method public, you're saying that any class, let's say, anywhere in the world can access this method. But what do I need to do in order to access that method? No. Well, yeah, but why is that the case? Why do I have to be part of the package? Because I just said public means anybody in the world can access it in any package. But you're right. So the question is, why are you right?
Because you want to know about that.
Why not? It's public. It's everywhere in the world, right?
Because you don't have knowledge of what's in that package. Because you are not part of the package.
But it's public. It's a public method. Yeah. I just said anybody anywhere in the world can access it. You're right, but you're missing that one piece. What's that one piece? What do I need to access a method? You should know this from your C++ experience. Is that true? Yes, it's true. What do I need to... Are you raising your hand? Or?
For the class?
Right. You need to know the class. If you want to access a method, you need to create an instance, or as we'll talk about today, you have to have access to the class itself. Who can access that class? What? I should say what. I shouldn't anthropomorphize things. What should access that class?
Anything in the package.
Right. Anything else? No, that's the conceptual difficulty. I've said that anybody in the world can access this method, but only people in this package can access the class. If I need the class to access the method, what's the point? This is what Jansen was saying. I'm giving a subset a larger number of members. Well, and that's why I objected to it, because it doesn't really make sense, but in one sense it does. I'm giving a subset a larger number of members than the parent set, which has a smaller set of access. So that's why you have a problem, or at least a conceptual difficulty. Yes, Matt?
If you have a static method, though, you can...
What? Static? What is that? We'll come to that. You can talk. You bring your question up then. That's the problem here. And my inclination is to say, oh, this is stupid. It doesn't make sense. But like I said, I've been burned saying that often enough in C++ that I'm not going to say it here. I'm just going to say, I don't really understand why anybody would want to do this. That is not the same thing as saying that no one would ever want to do it. And again, if you have a public scope method, then it has the public keyword. Otherwise, it is package default. Here's an example. I have a package A, public class CA. I have a public method called void and I have a public method called yes and a package default method called no. And then in package B, I have class CB, which accesses an instance of A, which is okay because CA is public. So it can access, create an instance of CA. It can access the public method yes, but it cannot access the package default method no, because it's in a different package. It's in the default package, actually, which is not the same as package A. And if we do the compilation, ta-da, there's the error. Cannot be accessed from outside the package. So again, the Java compiler agrees with me. Well, actually, no, this is a different issue. Never mind. I'm sorry. So that is the third member of our scope mechanism. There's packages, classes, and methods. We're going to introduce a few more as we go along, but for now, those three will satisfy. I will now introduce a new permission or a new access permission mechanism. What are the three? What are the two we've talked about so far? Default, right, package default, or just most of the time people just say package, but I like to say package default to emphasize the fact that if you don't do anything, you're going to get package access. Package and public. The third one is, of course, private. A method M with private scope can only be accessed by features within the same class as M. This is no different from, although actually if you get down nose to nose with the syntax, it is different. I'm sorry, not syntax, but semantics. If you get nose-to-nose with the semantics, it is different from C++. On the other hand, for our purposes, it's the same. At the moment, and this is why I'm introducing the private access mechanism, or the private access key attribute here, is because of the things that we've talked about, the only one that makes sense to declare private are methods. As we go along, we will introduce new features, new facilities, which can be declared private, but for now, just methods, so I'll introduce it here. Private scope methods have the private modifier. Syntactically, they're closer together. C++ and Java are syntactically closer together than they are semantically. It's actually kind of difficult to figure out what private means in C++. In fact, it does not mean inaccessible. You can actually access private things in C++ from outside the class, and I'm not talking about friends either, which is a legal gaping hole in the C++ access mechanism. But there are sub rosa things that you can also do. We will introduce a new member to our scope party, and that is the instance variable scope. An instance variable can have public, package, or private scope. Again, the same as methods, familiar to you from C++. By default, instance variables also have package scope. Again, if you don't do anything, you get the package default. This is a bad default. This is, again, one of the reasons why I don't like Java. Instance variables should almost always be private. It would have been far preferable had they declared all instance variables private as the default, but they didn't. It's important. It is incumbent upon you when you write your programs to add that or have your IDE add it. There is, I believe, at this point, a footnote that says, well, because you notice I have the weasel word in here, almost. It turns out, What are some instances where you would not want to have a instance variable be, let's see, do I want to say this now or later? Let me save it. Let me ask that question later. But it is a bad default. You always make your instance variables private. And we'll come back and adjust that always to mean most of the time. Public or private scope, again, is indicated by the public or private modifier. Without those, you get the default, which is bad. Access rules are the same as they are for methods. Now we have a fourth in. But, of course, instance variables are passive. They don't, in turn, access anything else. Methods can access other methods, but instance variables can't access anything but internal state, which we don't care about. Well, the fact that the access rules are the same as for methods doesn't really make much difference here. Although, again, if you need to think about it, that's how you would think about it. Now we can come back and redeem Matthew's comment about static. By default, when you call a method, if you just don't think about it, and you say, oh, I want to call the print method, what you are doing is you are calling a method on a class instance. This goes back to our discussion about why it doesn't make any sense to have a public method in a at least less than public class. Because in order to access that method, I need some access in some form to that class. And if I'm not in the package, I can't get access to the class, so it doesn't make any difference whether I can see the method itself. That's an example of what's known as an instance method. It's called upon an instance of the class. We had this discussion earlier with respect to what? We had a variant of this discussion earlier with respect to what? I like this bothering the students every time. Every method is called relative to an instance of the class. How do you represent that class? That class instance? Which is? That's right. What's the name? Careful.
Pointer to an object?
That's a type. There are no pointers. There are references, as we'll talk about maybe today. Oh, come on. Right. Called?
Whatever you name.
No. Called? This. Oh, you need to know that. You need to understand that, because if you don't, you're just going to be off. You're going to be drifting in a void. You're not going to be understanding what's going on. We had this discussion earlier about what is the meaning of this. It's certainly true that outside the method, you can call the instance whatever you want. You know, T, class T, small t, new class T. But inside the method, that instance is called this, regardless of what the name is from the outside. A method manipulates the instance's state, among other things that it can manipulate. If there's no class, so what this means is, if you don't have a class instance, then you can't call the method, because there is nothing there, there's no value you can assign to this. Everyone got it up to here? So an immediate question should be, well, what about constructors? What's the deal there? Where's the instance there? And in fact, there isn't one. You're calling constructor to get the instance back. So what about constructors? I actually decided I didn't like this. My suspicion is, I started to look into it. My suspicion is this is completely wrong. But so you want to put maybe little asterisks around the things I'm going to be saying here. And I'll explain why once we get through it. The constructor is an example of what's known as a class method. This is certainly true for small talk, and this, I suspect, is where the problem is. The things I'm going to say are true for small talk. Unfortunately, we're not talking about small talk here. We're talking about something else. A constructor is an example of what's known as a class method, a method that's called without reference to an instance. What that means, you can immediately conclude from the definition I just gave you, that there's no this inside a class method, because there's no instance. Now, of course, this is immediately wrong, since we argued earlier when we talked about the names of parameters within a constructor. So that's one of the little clues that I'm not quite correct here. A method becomes a class method using what's known as the static modifier. So that's where Matthew introduced the concept of static. So you would say something like static double sine double of x. The static and scope mechanisms are independent. So in other words, actually that's wrong. It should be static and access. It's also, could you say independent of scope? Does that make sense? I think it does make sense to say it's independent of scope. But certainly the examples I give here are not of scope, but rather of access. So the static and access are independent. You can have a static public, you can have a static private, you can have a static package access. That's the point here. So I should fix that. Another thing I should say, this goes back to the issue of terminology. If you remember, when we talked about fields, I said that I'm going to introduce what is non-standard terminology because I think the standard terminology is not as descriptive and perhaps is even confusing. And the non-standard terminology helps clear that up. The idea of calling these things class methods is non-standard. Generally speaking, they're called static methods, as Matthew called them. I find that to be unhelpful for two reasons. First of all, it doesn't really tell you anything. That's static. What does that mean? You have to remember that static means that it is, there's no instance around, you're talking about the class itself. Whereas if you say class method, then it's obvious. The other thing is that static is going to be overload. I think when we get to the end of this course, we are going to have five different meanings for the keyword static. So it's best to unpeel some of those and assign them to other words just to keep things clear. So I'm going to be calling them static methods and instance methods. Generally speaking, instance method is also non-standard. They're usually just called method if you are not dealing with a static method. So you have the normal the normal Java terminology is static method or method. I'm going to be calling them class method and instance method. If the context makes it clear, I'll just say method. But I will try and indicate which kinds of methods I'm talking about. Okay, class method access. Class methods are accessed using the name of the containing class. So it is almost the same as the access you get from instance methods, except that rather than have the name of the reference, as I guess it was Jordan pointed out, you would have the class name. In addition, if you need to have the package qualification, you would do that too. That's no different from anything else. Syntax. There's some syntax that you can use as you could use to get rid of the package qualifications. There is some syntax that you can use to get rid of the static qualification of the class name, and those are known as static imports. They look almost the same as the import mechanism that you use, except that you set static after import. So it's import static and then class.static method. This will now allow you to refer to static method without having to refer to class or, for that matter, the package qualification if you need it. In addition, you have this star wildcard. Give me access to all the static methods in a particular class. My recommendation is you don't use this, but you may do as you wish. Class versus instance methods. This is something you really need to understand. Fortunately, this is the same as it is for most other languages, for example, C++. If you've wrestled through this with respect to C++, although it's a little bit harder to see in C++ because you actually have two different kinds of classes, right? You have classes referenced through a pointer, and then you have the actual sort of block of code associated with a class. But the property is still the same. Class methods can directly access only other class methods. Directly access. Okay, why is that? Why can't a class method directly access, in other words, not going through the dot notation, an instance method? I sort of just gave you the answer there, but. That's true. It doesn't have a this, but rephrase that to make it a little bit more, I don't know what.
If you're a class method,
right.
You don't have an instance of yourself.
That's right. There's no instance to call the method through. If you need, again, if you're going to access an instance method, you need to reach it through an instance. In an instance method itself, it can directly call another instance method because you have this, which is the name of the instance that the original instance method was called on. In the case of a class method, you don't have an instance. There is no this, so you cannot directly call another instance method in the same class. That's an important point. Instance method, which I guess is what this is. A class method can access instance methods via a class instance. So if I create an instance of the same class, then I can access the class methods because I now have an instance. But that's an indirect access through the instance as opposed to directly accessing it through the body of the class method. Instance methods can directly access class methods. The fact that a class method has no instance has no effect on an instance method's ability to access a class method, because you can always access the class, regardless of where you are. Well, that's actually not quite true. Let me just back that up and say within the same package. And of course, we're within the same class, so it's certainly true there. You can also, however, go through the class name if you want, just to make it clear that you're accessing a static or a class method in the same class. Here's an example of that. I have a class blob with a static void class method. So this is a class method. And a instance method, 2. And another class method, class method 3 here. Picture looks like this. I have a class blob with 2 associated methods, CM1 and CM2. I create an instance of a blob. Now I have an instance, so now I can call through to the instance method, so I have IM2. So let's take a look at what we do in the class method 3. I can call CM1. This is a class method, so I can call CM1 directly. No, I don't need anything out here. I can also, if I want, put something out there. So I can call class.cm1. Don't need to, but you can if you want for documentation purposes. I cannot do this. This is a direct call to an instance method. I don't have an instance. I can't make a direct call. So this will, if you try and compile this, you will get the error message right here. I can go on. I can create an instance of B, however. No problem there. Now that I have an instance, I can access instance method 2. Perfectly okay. Furthermore, I can access, and this is confusing, but you can do it, I can access the class methods through an instance. I don't recommend you do this because this is misleading. It will work. That's fine. There's nothing. It compiles. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just, it looks like you're dealing with an instance method here when, in fact, you're dealing with a class method. So I don't recommend that you do this, but you can. Make sure you understand what this diagram is saying, what this picture is, or what this slide is saying to you. It's important that you understand this. If you don't, you're going to get confused.
Let's say you do have the b.cm1, where you call the instance method from within there.
Okay.
What's calling cm1 if you don't have that? Like, if you took that out, it would still compile. What would be calling cm1?
You mean if I have this?
Yeah.
So that's just like this. If I get rid of this, then I have this, right?
Well, what would be the thing that's calling that? Whatever called the void CM3 to begin with?
Yes. I guess I'm not understanding your question.
Like, how is that being called, I guess, is what I'm saying. Like, there's not. It's a class method, so.
Right.
You can call it from, basically from any. Anywhere in your code.
Within the same class. We'll skip the access permissions at this point.
Okay.
We'll just look at the class, which, you know, regardless of the access permission you give it, you can always access from inside the class. So within the same class, that's right. That's right. The question is, what referent do you need to have that access be legal? Okay. In the case of an instance method, you need to have a referent to that instance that you want to call that method on. In this case, the referent is, this is a class method. If I had another instance method here, which I didn't have room for, suppose I had, well, we can do this. Let's give ourselves void. I guess it would be 4. All right, this is an instance method, right? Because there's no qualifier out here, so it gets the default qualifier, not qualifier, but there's no static out here. So I can do this. This is legal. This will compile. Where is the referent here? This is an instance method. I said that every instance method needs a referent. Where is the referent? What is the referent? Yeah. Did you raise your hand?
Yeah, I wasn't sure.
Yes. Right. It's equivalent to putting this dot. You do. The problem is you don't need to put it in. The compiler will put it in for you. The same way that you remember what I said. How should you think of this? Right. It's that hidden secret parameter that gets passed into every instance method that contains the reference to the instance on which you're making the method call. So in fact, this should not be written like this. And if you're a Python programmer, you know this. Is that still true? Has anybody used Python 3? Did they fix that? Well, I say fix it. I assume it's implicitly what the compiler does is it sticks another parameter in there, which is the this parameter. So whenever you do something like this, I shouldn't say this. Whenever you make an instance method call like this, arg1, dot, 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 the compiler translates that into imta1, dot, dot, dot. That's one way to think about what's going on here. Because, in fact, that's what's the case. You only have one instance method. When you define an instance method, you only have one of them. That's not going to be true when we get to instance variables. So this makes perfectly good sense. You can just create one instance of the method and then pass in the particular reference to the instances that you're calling it on. This is the translation. This is how the translation goes. And again, you really need to understand this because this is the way that you can wrap your head around what's going on. I haven't found any other way. I haven't really needed to because this pretty much explains everything you need to know. There may be other ways, but I haven't thought of them because I haven't needed to. I don't think I answered your question, but unfortunately I don't remember what your question was. What was your question?
I think I understand it now.
All right, well, why don't you tell us what you understand?
Right, well, I guess what I was thinking of was when you're calling an instance variable.
Right.
Not an instance variable, a class variable.
A class method.
A class method.
Right.
Let's say you're calling that from outside of the class.
What is the access permission on the class method?
Well, it would have to be public for that, right?
No, it could be package default if you're in the same package.
Okay. When you call that from, let's say you're in main and you call CM3.
Okay.
What is the class, what is the, there's no this.
Right. So what you have to do, what's the answer to Matthew's question? Does everyone understand it? Suppose I have another class here, class card, I have some method, I don't care what it is, F, and you can put whatever you want out here. Now I want to call, CM1. I want to call CM1 in card, I want to call this class method. What do I do? Let's not put import static in just yet. What do I do? Right. Notice here I'm not following convention. This is supposed to be a capital letter. Oh, well, that's life. blob.cm1. Outside of the blob class, I have to do this. I have to identify the class with which that class method is associated. Inside the class, I don't have to, because if I do just this, all right, that's the problem. I need another term for this, but I can't think of one right offhand. If I do something like this, that's not very helpful, the class method of the same name in the same class gets first dibs. That's even true if, for example, card also implements CM1. Suppose that I implement, So now in card, I also have CM1. And let's assume that these are in the same package. Now the question becomes, what does this mean? Again, by the interpretation of the rules, the CM1 in the same class as the referring method gets first dibs. So this goes to, this is equivalent to blob.cm1 or here. If I want to access the other one, then I have to do card. Now, I could mess that up, and I'm not sure about this, but I could mess that up probably by doing this. Let's assume that these are both in the same file, and I have an import static up on the top. That opens up card.cm1 and allows me to refer to it as CM1. Now, this is ambiguous because it's not at this point clear whether I'm referring to the CM1 in blob or the CM1 in card, and I would have to resolve that by actually sticking blob.cm1 here. So you want to be careful when you do this, when you open up these static imports, which is why I don't recommend you do this, because that could cause name clashes. Certainly introducing them selectively is fine, but just opening up everything is not a good idea. Now, you could argue that, well, if that's the case, then you may very well have poor class design, because you really shouldn't have a lot of static methods in your class. That is the hallmark of somebody who's a procedural programmer writing object-oriented code. See, the problem with Java is you need to be an object-oriented programmer because that's all you have. Right? But if you're a procedural programmer, if you're somebody who's coming from the C world, all you have is procedures. Well, heck, static methods look a lot like procedures, right? So if you're looking at a method, or if you're looking at a class that has a tremendous number of static methods, the little red flag should go off in your head saying, oops, this was probably written by somebody who wasn't really playing the game right, because they are trying to create C programs or Pascal programs or whatever in Java using statics. That turns out not to be quite true in the case of the Sun Library, because there are a lot of Java classes that have a lot of static methods. The math methods, for example, they're almost all static. And that is an indication of poor design. And in fact, if we get to it, which we may not, we can talk about why that's the case. Any questions about this? This is, again, this is important. So make sure you understand this. If not now, then when you go and read Horseman. Well, I don't need to erase this right now. Let's go on. Okay, now we can talk about main. Java programs, as opposed to Java applets, start executing in the main method, which has the form public static void. This is the legendary public static void. Just write this down. That's what you tell people who are learning programming from Java. Just write this down, which is a terrible way to teach anybody anything. The problem that I have, I still have this, is what I call the sticky static problem. Because main is static, I don't know if I want to take even more time, but why not? Why is main static? Why does it have to be static?
Is it being called by the runtime?
That's true, but I don't see why that means that main. You're right, but I don't see why that means that main has to be static.
Then it doesn't have to create an instance of.
Exactly. The problem is you have a little bootstrapping problem here, right? If I want to run my program, I have to create an instance of, and I don't have main being static, then I have to create an instance of that class and then call it. But if my program isn't running, how do I create an instance of that class? So you have a bootstrapping problem here, in a sense. The way you get around that is you say, well, it's static, main is static, which means I don't need an instance of a class, I just need the class itself, which you have. That's the class file. So that's why main is static. Unfortunately, that has a bad property, which means that, what is that bad property? This is the consequence of that bad property, but what is the bad, well, I don't want to say bad property, let me just say property. we just talked about. What's the consequence of having a static method? Again, that is an access attribute problem, not so much. Anything that it directly accesses must also be static. So any direct accesses also have to be static, which means that what happens is the static access method, now we're not talking about access method, we're actually talking about scope here. The static scope spreads to everything that main touches. And I had this problem with that factorial program I sent around. Remember, the factorial program had two methods, main and then it had the actual factorial. When I first wrote that, I did not have the actual factorial computation be static, because usually you should not write static things, static methods. And of course, when I compiled my program, I got an error, because essentially what happens is that main calls the factorial, it gets the arguments, and it checks to make sure it's all right, and if everything's okay, it then calls the factorial method to compute the factorial. Well, if the factorial method is not static, it's an instance method, which means that I would need an instance of that class, which I didn't have. So what I had to do is I had to go back and make the program work. I had to put static in front of the factorial method. And that's what I mean by sticky static. It spreads throughout the program. And I've done that, I'm embarrassed to admit it, I've done that like to a level of 5. I've written a program, it doesn't compile because I'm directly accessing things that aren't static. So I put the statics in there, and what happens there? There's direct accesses to other things that aren't static, so it still won't compile. So I'll go back and put in more static. And, it takes 5 iterations to go all the way through. When you find yourself doing that, you're doing it wrong, as the young people like to say today. If you find yourself spreading statics throughout your code to get it to compile, then you've got a bad design. And what you should do is, and there's a number of different ways to fix it, depending upon what the actual problem is. But generally speaking, what you do is you take main out, move it to a completely separate class that is nothing but main. That way, anything you access has to be done either through the normal mechanism of creating an instance and using an instance method, or you're accessing a static method in some other class. Therefore, you don't have this sticky static problem. Now, again, this assumes that you're as dumb as I am and you'll make the same mistakes that I am. If that's not the case, then you can just forget all about it. But I don't know. And I've seen other people have the same problem too. So here's an example. Oh, this is just what I was talking about. So here's my main, which I know has to be static because they told me type static public void main. So I type that. And now I want to print out what the factorial of I is. All right, so I do this. I do a bunch of stuff up here, and then I do this, and I call fact. Fact is written like that, because that's how you write methods, right? You just type the method in. You don't remember that it needs to be static. So this is not. This is an instance method, and I'm calling it directly from main. Of course, that doesn't work. Cannot be referenced from a static context. Ah, damn. So now you go back, and you put the static in. You see, static is spreading. And now if you compile it, it works. I didn't do the compilation here. But if this made a direct access to something, right, that was non-static, you would get another error message up here saying, non-static context. So you have to go in and put a static someplace else. When you find yourself doing that, stop and think. What should I do? And in this case, what I recommend you do is put factorial. Well, pretty much factorial has to be a static method, right, because it's like sine. Factorial does not belong to any particular number. Okay, in this sense, Java is not a pure object-oriented language like Smalltalk is. So it doesn't make any sense to talk about having particular numbers and applying the factorial to them. You need to invert that and say that, well, factorial is a property of class of integer, for example, or in this case, big integer, I guess we were doing. And then it would be static because there's no particular instance with which you associate factorial. All right, now we can move down to instance variables. As it was with methods, so it is with instance variables. You can have a instance variable, or you can declare it to be static and have a class variable. The proper terminology here would be static variable, but I find that to be unhelpful. Saying class variable makes it clear the context within which you should access that variable, and you don't have to make the connection class static. It looks like this. Again, another keyword in front, static public double pi, for example. Static, again, static and scope and access are independent. Class variables in general, however, should be either private to the class itself, or if it's public, they should be immutable. This, in fact, is not an immutable. So this is a bad example because this is not immutable. We haven't actually talked about the keyword that will give you an immutable, in this case, double. Class and instance method access class variables. Classes and instance methods can access class variables independent of scope. Again, same thing with methods. So the behavior here is the same as it was for methods. With respect to class variables, they're always there for you, whether you're a class or whether you're an instance method in that class. And that is all we're going to talk about with respect to scope, entities under which scope can occur, and the access permissions that you can have on those entities within scope. Any questions about that? Again, it's important that you keep the combinatorics of this straight. I've added a new entity, so now we have four different kinds of entities times three different kinds of scopes and three different kinds of access methods. So you do that multiplication, and now you have a lot of things that you have to think about. And as we go along from week to week, I'm going to add things to that. All right, we're going to have another access attribute. We're going to have two more entities, I believe, at least. And I think we're going to have two more scopes. Right, so it's going to get complicated, and we're actually more or less going to use all of those. So you need to start to wrap your head around it when it's small so that when it starts to grow, you can follow along. What I'd like to do now is talk about something which Horstman and Cornell talk about. Otherwise, I wouldn't be talking about it because I don't think it really belongs here. And that's the idea of comments. That reminds me. Your first programming assignment is out. And I will have more to say about that on Thursday once you've had a chance to look at it. I had another bright idea I had on the way over, which I'll have to think about whether I want to do it or not. We have to discuss what you're going to do for honors, right? So one of the things that occurred to me that we could do is rather than get together, you and I, and sort of hash out what you want to do, which I actually have something in mind for you to do, is to put in each assignment something that anybody, because, I mean, why should just you two be honors students? Everybody can be an honors student if they want. So it occurred to me what I could do is, in the assignment, I could put an optional section, which would be the honors section. And if you want honors assignment, if you want honors credit for this class, you would have to do all the honors options on the assignment. So that's another, and again, that's another one of my brainstorms outside as I was walking here to work. So I think I'm going to do that. Now, of course, you might want, if you want to object, you can do that after class because, you know, it's sort of, not, although we haven't gone through the details yet about what that means to do honors work in this class, but it occurred to me that, you know, if other people want to do honors, try for honors credit, well, what the hell, why not let them? Which is a roundabout way of saying that I may actually be adding I may add this honors thing to the assignment, and if you want to do it, then you just would complete the honors part in addition to the regular assignment. Now, one thing I have to check and make sure that's okay, because right, I guess you weren't when you were in Joe's class last semester. Whenever it was, you were formally enrolled in the honors program, were you? Because you said he gave you honors credit at the end.
You were.
See, that's the only sticking point here is that my assumption is I can retroactively give you honors credit for the class. And if that's not true, then what I want to do is stupid. It doesn't make any sense. So I should check and make sure whether that's the case. Because I was under the impression that you were just sort of like doing work, and then Joe said, poof, you're an honors, you get honors credit.
He did.
Oh, is that what happened?
Yeah, but I think like they changed the
rules. Oh, they changed the rules. Yeah. All right, well, let me check and get back to you. But if that is possible, if I can retroactively give you honors credit for this class, then I will do that. I'll put an extra section on the assignment, and if you want honors credit, we'd have to figure out what you'd have to do. You'd pretty much have to get 100 on it because, after all, you're an honors student. But let me do that, and then we'll figure it out on Thursday. All right, let's buzz through comments. This is going to be important because, again, this is a writing class, and you will be, as you'll see on the assignment, this will also start your first part of the writing assignment. You'll be writing JavaDoc for your assignment, so that's what we're going to talk about now. Comments can either be single or multi-format, multi-line format. Again, this is C++. You can do the double slash or the slash star, star slash. This is the multi-line. Multi-line comments do not nest. I lost money on this. I made a bet and I lost. So they don't nest. Although, when I wrote my compiler, I didn't write a C++ compiler, they did nest. There's no excuse for them not to nest. And I got bitten by that. But anyway, that's a different matter. Java.comments are multi-line comments of the form slash star star. That's how you introduce a Java.comment. So first of all, you can't have single-line Java.comments. You've got to use the multi-line format. And secondly, you put little stars here. Make sure that it's just slash star star. It can't be slash star star star. If you want to do that, you have to go slash star star space star star star. And this has to be, this ends like that. And then you put stuff in here, which is what we'll talk about next. What you get out when you do all of that is the things that you see, for example, in the API documentation when you're sitting in your IDE and you say, oh, let's see, strings. How do I trim stuff from the end of a string? Right? You get something that looks like this, and then you wind your way down to whatever you're looking for in terms of methods or constructors or instance variables and so forth and so on. The java.comments are essentially text comments with HTML tags and at keywords. The at keywords are the extension to the java.doc system. So they're part of java.doc. Everything else is either text, straight text, or HTML. The java.doc parses the at keywords and then passes along the HTML unprocessed. Be careful when you mix HTML and at keywords, though. You have to understand where you are passing in HTML and where you are passing in the not only the at keywords, but the parameters for the at keywords, as we'll see. I occasionally get this wrong because I want it to look one way, and Javadoc wants it to look some other way, and of course Javadoc wins in that case. Generally speaking, you're going to be documenting features in your program. You're going to be documenting packages, you're going to be documenting classes, you're going to be documenting methods, you're going to be documenting instance variables. All that documentation precedes the entity that you are documenting. So the Javadoc comments for a instance variable are going to appear before, let me not say instance variable, let me say field variable, because you can do either. The Javadoc comments for a field variable will appear before the field variable. The Javadoc comments for a class will appear before the class. That's important because if you're like me, you like to put your comments inside of things as opposed to on top of things because the connection between the two then becomes much more clear. Oh well, that's life. Javadoc can document packages, classes, methods, and variables. It can also document other things. Horseman talks about it, but I'm not going to go into the details here, and I'm not going to require that you do that, although you can if you'd like. Class comments, so now we're just going to go down the list of things that you can document, and I'll give you some of the commands that you can use, but not all of them. You can look up the rest if you're interested. A class comment should immediately precede the related class. There's a lot of at keywords that you can use with respect to a class. The ones that are most useful are at author, at version, and at deprecated. You shouldn't really need to use any of those. I mean, it might be nice if you put at author in, but you know, I know who you are. So, and version, I don't think we really need to get that into it. Deprecated, again, you shouldn't. Well, actually, you might actually want to deprecate things, depending upon how the assignment goes, but I wouldn't worry about that. One thing that I find extraordinarily annoying, and I don't want you to do it because you'll annoy me, is if you deprecate something, right, make sure you indicate what it has been replaced by. Nothing drives me up the wall quicker to use some feature that's documented only to find out it's deprecated, which means that you shouldn't use it, but then it doesn't tell me, the documentation doesn't tell me what I should use instead. If I'm not supposed to use something, and you just haven't deleted it completely from the system, right? In some cases you might want to do that, like I mentioned, what did I mention? Killing a thread from some other thread. Right? That was deprecated, and they did not replace it because it's a stupid thing to want to do anyway. Right? So in that case, you would just indicate in the documentation, this is deprecated, and you should never, ever do it. Right? As opposed to just saying, this is deprecated, and now I get to sit there and say, all right, now what do I need to do if I want to do this? Right? More generally, what you're going to say is, this is deprecated, and you should use this instead. But most people forget, and you should use this instead. So if you're going to deprecate something, make sure that you indicate whether it should be done at all, and if it should, what you should use instead. That's the end of my rant. By default, only public classes are documented. On the other hand, I will expect you to document all of your everything. Right? Because when I generate the Java doc from your code, I am going to essentially say, you know, show me all the comments. When you look at the public API like this, you are only looking at the public methods and public classes and public instance variables and so forth and so on. All right, so the default is to just show me the public stuff. I am going to be looking at everything, so you should document everything. And you can play games, you know, you can show various subsets. So for example, generally they'll have the developer's documentation, which doesn't have the public stuff but has everything else. So, but I'm going to look at everything. Method comments immediately precede the related method, as we talked about. Useful at keywords for methods includes the at param, at returns, and at throws. Javadoc performs sanity checks on the keywords. For example, it will tell you if you have a parameter in your method that doesn't have an at param. So you're missing a documentation on a particular method. If you have an at param that doesn't show up in your parameter list, it will tell you that too. By default, again, only public and protected methods are documented. Document all your methods. Instance variable comments. Instance variable comments precede the instance variable. I should say not instance, but I should say field, because you can also do this for class comments. Field. By default, again, public and protected variables are documented. Document them all. Here's an example. I don't know why I didn't show examples of the other ones. Start of Javadoc, end of Javadoc. This is just text, and this can contain HTML. And so you can do all kinds of whizzy things in here if you want. This is the description that tells you what this particular instance variable does. Here's an example, and this is actually relevant to what I was thinking about I was going to have you do. Here's an example of a keyword that you make up yourself. Javadoc is nice in the sense that you can extend it to recognize other keywords and do other kinds of formatting. So in this case, I'm defining a new keyword called invariant, and I'm specifying an invariant for this instance variable. Essentially, the rank should be between 0 and 12. You could put other information in here. I don't know what. Maybe revisions or who knows what. But this is essentially all you need to do is indicate what the instance variable. Notice that this is private, too, whereas before I said it was public, only public and protected get, by default, Javadoc documentation generated. Other comment types, there are package and overview documentation. Overview is like for your entire project, if you want to do it that way, framework or subsystem. These comments require separate HTML files. It's actually a little bit more complicated than that, but if you look at the Javadoc man page, for example, you can get the details there. The package and overview files are called package.html and overview.html. You have to actually invoke specific command line arguments to see that documentation. The file placement depends upon the directory structure. So package.html goes into the package directory. If you want to document a particular package, you would put your package.html into the package directory you want to document, any one of them. Again, remember we have these multiple packages. Overview.html goes in some ancestor directory of the system that you're trying to document, and you would have to point Javadoc to that particular file since it otherwise wouldn't know where to look. To run Javadoc, it's actually a complicated program, surprisingly complicated, but generally speaking, simple invocations will do. One important caveat I'll throw in here, and we'll have an example of that on the next slide, I believe, is make sure that you have a separate documentation directory. This is particularly true the first time you run Javadoc, because now the first time you say is you just type Javadoc and it'll run, and then you get, as we'll see, a whole bunch of junk, and then you have to go through and clean it up. Javadoc generates a lot of files, as you might expect. So you want to use the -d command line option to send those files to a particular directory, or you can run Javadoc in the documentation directory, but then you have to be a little careful about directing attention to the appropriate package directories. Quirks of Javadoc, and this is actually kind of important. Javadoc is a chatty program that prints a lot of stuff as it's working, which I find to be extremely annoying. On the other hand, it does produce warnings, like I said. You know, it said it may produce a warning that says, oh, you know, you have a method and this parameter hasn't been documented yet. That's going to be important, because if you don't document everything, you're going to get points off. So you want to be able to see those warnings, but they're being interwoven with all this other junk that JavaDoc produces. You can use the quiet command line option to get rid of all that chatter and just see the warnings. By default, as I mentioned earlier, JavaDoc only documents public or protected features. You can use the private or package command line options. This should actually not be or here, because you can use these in combination to document more features. And this is what I'm going to do on your assignments. Here's an example. I have two directories, the implementation directory and the player API directory. These are package directories. I run JavaDoc. I say be very quiet and look in these two package directories. If I do an ls again, I find I have all this junk in the same directory. Here is my original two directories, and then I have all this other junk in there. All right, so now what you got to do is you got to go through and clean all that crap out, make sure you don't delete your directories. You want to delete everything else. So you get back to where you were at the beginning, and then you run JavaDoc again. This time you say, put all that stuff you're going to generate into the directory doc. Right, that's what the minus D does. Everything else is the same. Be quiet when you're doing it. Implementation and player API, package directories. Now if I do my ls, I have another directory called doc. When all this other stuff has been written into doc, some of this is directory here. For example, I think this is a directory which contains other things beneath it. And now if I want to look at it, I can just run my browser on doc/index.html, and that takes me to the root of my directory hierarchy, and then from there I can click around to wherever. And so here would be an example JavaDoc session. Most IDEs will do this for you if you want, if you set it up appropriately, or you can just do like me and have a make file, so you type doc and it generates all this stuff for you, you can look at it. All right, questions about that?
Does it matter where you put the private and public requirement to get?
Oh, you mean these? These? I don't think so. I'm not sure, though. I'd have to look. I mean, I usually just treat them as I treat Unix command line arguments, which is put them before any options, before any mandatory. But now that I think about it, I think at one point I was putting this over here, and it still worked. Certainly if you do it the Unix way, which is to put all the command line arguments first and then the mandatory arguments second, that should work fine. Within the set itself, private, protected, public, so forth, you can permute those in any order you want. That doesn't matter. Okay, as I mentioned, you can generalize JavaDoc using your own at keywords. You can also do other nifty things. For example, generate PDFs rather than web pages. Doclet generalizes JavaDoc. Again, this is something you would be working on. Create new document components and document formats. This turns out to be very useful, particularly if you're using something like the Enterprise Edition, where you have to generate enormous, enormous amounts of boilerplate. So what you do is you document what you want in terms of the JavaDoc in the code, and then you run a doclet over it that would generate the boilerplate associated with that code, for example, bean containers and things like that. That turned out to be very nice with respect to EE, people who do EE systems, Enterprise Edition, Java Enterprise Edition. To summarize, scope, sets, and entities, extent, and accessibility, public, package, default, and private. Now, you see, that's wrong. Those are actually, that should be class, method, and package. Oh, these of course, are access permissions, not scope. All right, so that's wrong. This is the scope. Classes, methods, and this should be packages, not fields. Well, this is just completely wrong. I don't know what I was thinking. Package groups, packages group related class files, packages sort and map onto directories, sort of map onto directories. Class path maps onto packages. And that should probably be directories onto packages. And JavaDoc is a cumbersome Swiss Army knife. You can really do a lot of interesting things with JavaDoc. So I don't know that it pays you now to learn JavaDoc, but if you do get a job on the other side of the server writing Java code, then it's, I would suspect it'd be very important that you learn how to do JavaDoc. That's it. Any questions? All right, seeing no questions, I will see you on Thursday, when we will have quiz for this week. Notice that we have not yet talked about Chapter 3, but fortunately, you have, of course, by that time, read Chapter 3.